This is the NYFC podcast. I'm Lindsay Lusher Shute. Every year in the United States, more farmers get close to retirement. For every farmer under 35, there are now six over 65. You'd think that all these older farmers would mean that there is more and more land available, yet finding farmland is still the hardest thing. Today, I'm talking with Holly Rippon Butler, the Land Access Program Director at the National Young Farmers Coalition. Holly talks about how complicated it can be to sell a farm, the problem of land access on a national scale, and a bill that she helped to get through the New York State Legislature this session. That bill is now sitting on Governor Cuomo's desk, and we are hoping that it can be a model for other states trying to figure out how you get farmland from one generation to the next.
This is Sophie Ackhoff, National Field Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. I've been a member of the coalition since 2012 because I believe that our food system will be healthier and more just if young farmers have a say in their future. For $35 a year, you can join too. In addition to helping young farmers make their voices heard, you'll get discounts like 16% off a two-wheel tractor at BCS America and 10% off at Premier One. It's a great deal. To join, simply go to youngfarmers.org.
All right, Holly, I'm going to start recording right now.
So I guess I'm just wondering, how big is this problem of land transition, land access, farmland access in the United States?
So land access is the top challenge that young farmers are facing. Anyone who's entering agriculture needs land to farm on that is secure, that they know will be there as they're building their business. And in our national survey that NYFC did in 2017, we found that for all of our respondents who are under 40, land access was their top challenge. And this was regardless of whether they had grown up on a farm or were entering agriculture for the first times in their lives, and regardless of geography, so in every region of the country. And this challenge exists now in greater proportions than it has in the past.
Help me understand this. This is a crazy situation. So we have all of these farmers who presumably are going to need to sell their land to the next generation, but they're holding on to it still. And then there are all these young people who are looking to get on the land, and land access is, in fact, their number one challenge. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, land, I mean, it's a non-renewable resource, so right. We only have so much of it, and it's very valuable. It's going up in value all the time. In some cases, there are folks out there who are doing what they call socially responsible farmland investment, where they're using long-term returns to help get farmers on the land, and people can invest in buying farmland that farmers can access. But in many cases, it is investors who might own the land and just rent it out for a short time and then be looking to sell for a high profit in the future. In other cases, there are just a lot of folks who have land in their family and recognize its value, either financial or sentimental or some degree of both, and aren't looking to sell it. And so you get a situation where a lot of farmers are renting, and In our survey, it was more than a third of farmers are only renting. They have no access to land that they own. So this creates a lot of instability for them as they try to start their business.
I think one of the things that you've talked about that I really appreciate so much is anchoring the work that we do on farmland access in sort of like values about what we believe is fair and right. In thinking about land and what like a farmer sort of has the right to or deserves, what are sort of those values that we should be thinking about when we think about what a farmer needs when it comes to farmland?
Well, one of the biggest disconnects right now for farmers when it comes to land is just the difference between what it costs to buy land and what they can possibly expect to make in income from farming on that land. It gets really complicated really quickly when you start talking about fairness of land, because of course all of the land in the United States was previously not in a private property system. You know, people came to this country and imposed that on the land. And we divide it up and we now sell it out of a completely constructed system. And that's something that's really important to have in mind, really, in many cases, and in all cases, took the land from other people who were there first. And so thinking about fairness of land ownership is really complex, and it's important to understand that history. I think
it's built on unfairness.
It's built on unfairness in many ways, and there's been a lot of economic unfairness along the path of creating this system of land ownership. Yeah, one of the major disparities that we talk about a lot in our day-to-day work now is just in real estate, people talk about highest and best use value a lot, and we have a fundamental issue there, I think, in that we talk about highest and best use as that land's value for development or for just who will pay the most for the land. And you know, we're in many cases ignoring what it has to offer that no other real estate asset can offer, which is its ability to produce food.
And support a community in so many other ways, right?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
disconnect between like what a farmer can pay based on selling carrots and what anybody else can pay based on maybe a non-farm income or even a farmer or certainly a developer. And I guess that's a fundamental value, right? That we believe you should be able to pay for your land with what you're growing on that land.
Yeah.
Which is so... Yeah. So basic, but we have to fight for that because there's so much that influences the market outside right. of agriculture. Agriculture is just we're just left behind.
It's like it's just in the it's the framework we apply to a resource. So if you're a water park developer, you look at water and you think about water slides. And if you're a fisherman, you look at that water and you think about how the fish that it could support. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. It's like we're looking at land and the loudest voices that are really winning in the real estate market and just in policy are the voices that would look at land that could be growing food and see it for its value to build houses on. I mean, if you think about land that's close to population centers and flat, it's good for a couple of things. One is shopping malls. The other good. Is farmland.
Right. So, and it kills me that it's also well-drained.
It's like well-drained and well-drained. Yeah, yeah.
Flat, that's, well-drained, shopping mall.
Shopping mall, yeah. And there are mechanisms out there that address this. Zoning sort of came out of the idea that if you buy a house, you probably want some kind of guarantee that in the next 10 years you're not going to be next to a confinement hog operation some kind of smelting factory or something. So there's some zoning came about to kind of help protect property values by separating uses within communities. So we can also use zoning to say that we place a value on keeping farmland from being developed and keeping it for agricultural use. The other major tool that we're really focused on is working with land trusts.
Yeah, what is one of those?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So a land trust is not, despite having the word trust in the name, it's not a bank. They are nonprofit organizations that exist around the country in the U.S. and in other countries as well. There's similar land trust concepts. And they... at their base level exists to protect natural resources. So you'll see land trusts that are protecting wildlife habitats, scenic view sheds, historically significant land or areas. And then land trusts can also decide to place a resource focus on farmland and protect farmland for farming.
But most land trusts, just to be clear, don't do that.
Yeah, there are about, as of a few years ago, there are about 2,000 land trusts in the United States, and when we did a survey of them in 2013, we found around a little over 200 that were doing some kind of agricultural work that we talked to. And I think...
And that's because in some cases, the land trust was put together to protect land from farming, too.
Yeah, so Within those 200 land trusts, I'd say there are a handful that were established specifically to protect farmland, and then quite a few more that are doing it as part of their work where they're also protecting natural habitat or open spaces. And so a land trust really is just a collection of people. They tend to be relatively small. Then there are some national ones, like the Trust for Public Land or the Nature Conservancy, that are much larger and have regional or state offices. But for the most part, land trusts are local. They're focused on a local resource, and they have either volunteers or staff, and then a board. They're governed by some IRS rules that keep them maintaining their nonprofit status. But they can do a number of things within that to protect the resource that they're focused on. So, you know, traditionally land trusts are mainly using conservation easements, which is a real estate tool, basically a legal tool, where you, as a land trust, can either accept donations or purchase the value of certain property rights.
Bundle of sticks, here it comes.
Bundle of sticks is the metaphor that many people use when they're talking about property rights. So you say your property is like a bundle of sticks. You don't just own a farm. You own all of the mineral rights, the development rights, the water rights, et cetera, that are associated with that farm.
With any property.
And with any property. So you can sell off your water rights, you can sell off your development rights, and you can sell off your mineral rights without selling ownership of that property. And so what a land trust is doing is sort of taking that concept and buying a right, such as the development right, that a farmer, in the case of farmland protection, that a farmer is not using, or accepting it as a donation, and permanently extinguishing that stick, putting it in a safe or...
They're putting it in their own pile.
Putting it in a pile, but they're more like burning it. They're extinguishing it. It's gone. So as a land trust, you take that right, you protect it, you take it off that property in perpetuity, forever. And there's a value attached to that that an appraiser will determine. So they'll take a look at what would someone pay for all the sticks altogether versus what would somebody be willing to pay for this land if that one stick was missing. So what will, in a farmland example, what would somebody pay? And likely this is where the highest and best use comes in. So in the case of a piece of farmland that's well-drained and flat and near a city, the highest and best use is probably going to be from a developer who, say, might pay $400,000 for that property or $700,000. Whatever it might be. And then once you take that development right stick away, that developer is no longer interested because they can't put their mall on the property. So then you're looking at, well, what would somebody pay for this land who couldn't use it in that way? And likely you've made the cost of the land much lower.
When I was first looking for farmland with Ben, we, and this is like the problem we ran into that got us feeling like farmers needed to get organized, was that there were land trusts around us who had, in fact, protected farmland, but that land was too expensive. What's happening there? You couldn't develop it, but it was still too expensive to, like, a farmer.
Right. They've removed the right to development, but there are an increasing number of people who are interested in farmland just for its open space value, for it's what they call amenity value. It's a beautiful place to live. You know that the fields around you won't have houses on them because they've been protected. And in many cases, you have some guarantee that the neighboring area probably will remain free from development as well, because land trusts tend to place value on protecting farms that are in areas near other protected farms or in areas that will remain in ag. And so you've got people purchasing farmland who are not farmers, who are interested in that land for other reasons, and that drives the price up as well.
Yeah, we see a lot of non-farmers buying protected land, which is a big problem. And so there's another stick there, right? Like, there's an opportunity to deal with that issue too.
Right. So there's another stick that land trusts can pull out of a property value, and that's looking at what would just farmer-to-farmer sales in an area make the value of this property. So what would, in other words, what would farmers be willing to pay for this land?
So if you took estate owners out of the picture.
Right. And so the stick that you're taking out there is the right to sell the property to someone who is not a farmer. To basically the right to sell the property higher than its agricultural use value. And the way that land trusts get at this in an easement is they add additional legal language to the easement called an option to purchase at agricultural value or a preemptive purchase right in New York.
Or what are we, the working farm easement.
Working farm easements. So yeah, so these working farm easements are stronger easements for farmers. They keep the land at its agricultural use value by saying that at the time of sale, it must be sold to a farmer. If no farmer is found, the land trust has the option to step in and purchase the land at its appraised agricultural use value, which is an appraiser looking at that property and determining what farmers could afford.
And who, and in that context, like who is a farmer?
So it depends on how the easement's written, and land trusts will write it differently. But in many cases, the easiest way to say it is just anyone earning 50% of their income or more from farming. If it's a new farmers who might not have that tax record, just analyzing their business plan and looking at, are they serious? Do they have the expertise to really farm this property? And so the, I think the land trusts that have some degree of flexibility around this determination, but also a backstop to rely on if they need to, have the most success.
So one of the critiques that I know I hear of the working farm easement or OPAF or PPR, just to put it all together, but working farm easements, as we like to call them, is that they're not great for beginning farmers. Do you think that's true?
So there's different things that we're talking about here. So land access for a beginning farmer might look very different than land access for a farmer who's in year 5 or 6 or even 10 of their business. A very beginning farmer buying land might not be appropriate for them. They might be looking to rent for a year or two just to get a sense of what they're looking to do, how figure out how their business is going to work. Do they like farming at all? Do they like where they're living? Those things are really important, and land ownership is really serious. It's a very serious, and if it's anyone who's ever bought a house or anything really even knows.
It's cool, but it's a lot of responsibility.
That's a good way to summarize it. And it's long-term. You know, often farmers might not be ready for land ownership right away, and so when we're talking about beginning farmers, the challenge that they face might be more finding a secure lease opportunity or just any land near where they want to be to farm. As farmers start to get more established, however, we believe this really flips, and they really, it becomes extremely important to them to have long-term security where they're farming. You know, land ownership is the best way and easiest way to get at this in our current real estate environment and the most practical way.
Yeah, I mean, I do hear some people are, in fact, just last week, some people I was talking to were just saying, farmers don't really need to own land. Like, why don't they just rent land forever? What do you think is the best response to that?
I think that they're potentially right. Not all farmers need to own land. But what farmers do need is long-term security. They need a place where they know they can put soil amendments onto their farm. They can build infrastructure that they need to grow their business. They can take out loans and have security to know they'll be in the same place making a reasonable income to pay those back over the long term. And they need some security for their personal lives as well, like a place to have a home where they know they can send their kids to school if they want to have kids, that sort of thing. And so if you think about, you know, people wanting all of those things, wanting to know that they'll be able to be in the same place year after year, they can put fence posts in if they have livestock or deer protection or that sort of thing, that often equates to land ownership. The other piece of that is that as a farmer, it's extremely hard to save for retirement, especially in the startup years. If you experience startup years over and over again by having to move to different properties, that really sets you back and burns you out very quickly. And so farmers who are thinking about saving for retirement or thinking about having some equity when they get older, land ownership is really an important tool for that as well. That said, I think that farmers don't need to own land if you can achieve all of these things through some other mechanism. And we work a lot with Equity Trust, and they've and a number of other groups that have started to use the ground lease tool, which is a very long-term lease that can be inherited and basically splits the property ownership in two. So the land trust would own the land and provide a long-term lease on the land to the farmer tenant, while the farmer would own the infrastructure and the buildings on the land.
And the term of this ground lease is 100 or 99 years, right? It's like a lifetime.
Yeah, so long as the state legislation enables leases that are that long, that would be the ideal length. Some states have, like California, places a restriction on the length of the lease. But
so, Holly, this the working farm easement, when we see these in place, it seems to work really, really well. Massachusetts has been doing this for over 15 years now. The Vermont Land Trust has transferred, you know, farmer to farmer, hundreds of farms at this point in Vermont. Like, what is holding other states back, other land trusts back from doing this more broadly? We have this huge issue of land nationwide needing to be transitioned to the next generation of farmers. Do you think that working farm easements are going to be part of that? And what's necessary to make that possible?
I think that really the answer to why aren't more folks doing this is a little bit twofold. One is that it's a fairly unknown tool. So we've been doing a lot of work over the last 4 years to raise awareness of this tool, to work with land trusts to talk through best practices. Really, the goal here is to inspire people to say, look, Massachusetts and Vermont and Equity Trust and other groups that have been doing these easements found the tool, they innovated. They found the tool that worked to address the problem. And we really want to inspire people to keep innovating, to keep either using this tool or figuring out what works best for protecting farms in their region and potentially creating something entirely new that is geared towards this idea of the working farm easement, of keeping protected farms in working farmer ownership. And so one of the issues has been just spreading awareness. The second challenge is really just finding the money to do this work. So buying easements costs money. And there is an option to donate easements, but that doesn't really help farmers so much who aren't going to get the benefits of the tax incentives of having donated an easement because their income is not that large in many cases. So really we're talking about having publicly available funding to purchase working farm easements. And we do have a federal program for this, and about half of the states have a state-level program for this as well. But funding that really is prioritizing easements that not only protect farmland but keep it in the hands of farmers is all really missing, and we're working to increase the availability of all that.
So there was a bill that passed, I heard. I was slacking with David at, well, and you, we were all like 11:30 at night. So anyway, we passed this bill. How does this relate to the working farm easement? What we haven't passed the bill. The New York State Legislature, the Senate, and the Assembly passed the Working Farms Protection Act, and now it's on to Governor Cuomo. What would that bill do, and how would it help to move the working farm easement forward in New York State?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, we were up until midnight one night watching the Senate pass this, our bill, out of the Senate and hopefully onto the governor's desk soon to be signed. That would be the last stage. So this bill, the Working Farm Protection Act, was the culmination of really years of talking to partners in New York, hearing both the challenge of our farmer members in the state, as well as talking to land trusts that were seeing this The challenge of land access as well. In New York State, we have a great farmland protection program that's been around for more than two decades and has really protected a huge amount of farmland. We've invested over $145 million and protected more than 61,000 acres of land in New York State for farming.
It's pretty good.
Which is amazing. But as we go into the third decade of the program, the challenges are shifting a bit, and we're noticing that farmers really can't access some of this land, and we're seeing non-farmer owners buy the land.
They can't access it because it's too expensive.
Because it's too expensive. And so land trusts are starting to address this, but the state Farmland Protection Program funding until this spring was not available to cover the added costs of putting a working farm easement on land. Land trusts could do these projects, but they could not utilize state funding for the added protection that would help keep the farm at its agricultural value into the future. So we worked with Assemblywoman Dee Dee Barrett and Senator Patty Ritchie, and they both helped get this bill onto the floor in the Assembly and the Senate, and we ended up with 32 co-sponsors in the Assembly and 16 in the Senate, and moved a bill forward that would permanently make New York State funding, farmland protection funding, eligible to cover the cost of working farm easements.
Because previously, the State Department of Agriculture said no working farm easements.
Right. As a land trust, you could submit a project that was a working farm easement for funding, but the state program would only cover the costs of purchasing that development rights stick, not the agricultural use value stick.
We should acknowledge that incorporated oftentimes in a conservation easement that will also preclude other types of uses on a given piece of land, right? So like also mining, for instance.
Yeah. So, right. And it's also very important to mention that easements are voluntary. We did not talk about that when we were talking about the definition of an easement, but the kind of easements we're talking about are, first of all, very different than access easements, which is another thing people talk about when they talk about land use. That might be like if a telephone company has some lines of telephones through your property, they'd have an access easement to service the telephone poles. That's very different than what we're talking about. And
this is something a farmer chooses to do.
Yeah, this is something a farmer chooses to do, completely voluntary, and you would place it on your property.
So New York State, before this spring, they said, we will fund only the normal part of a working farm easement, but not this additional aspect of it that makes it affordable to farmers. But in the spring, on their own, even before the bill, they made this announcement that they will fund also the additional expense of the working farm easement because they too acknowledge this issue of farmland being too expensive. And then the bill will make this law.
Yeah, right, exactly. So amazingly, right, while we were working on getting the bill passed, the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets, which runs the Farmland Protection Program, released their latest round of funding, requests for proposals from land trusts for farmland protection projects. And they did include that these added costs of putting working farm easement were eligible. So that was really exciting. And we're still really excited to get the bill passed because it would be the first bill, as far as we know, in the country, the first state in the country to put this kind of farmland protection measure into statute. And the bill, I think, is really it's really important for a number of reasons. This is, you know, it's adding protecting farm operations to the purpose of a farmland protection program, which is pretty new. Typically, these farmland protection programs exist to protect the soils or protect farmland. But we, in the bill, added protecting farm operations. It also calls out the lack of access to affordable farmland as a threat to farms in New York State and the future of farms, acknowledging that if we don't continue to get farmers onto this land, you know, we've had an open space protection program, not a farmland protection program, because farmland without farmers is just land.
That's so important that it's just incomplete. It doesn't work if you're just protecting the land and not the people to manage it. They're as much a part of the land as anything else, a working landscape.
Right. And the bill also, the other thing that it does that's pretty new is calling out that, you know, with the intention of the working farm easement is the intention that the new owner will maintain the land in agricultural production and that they must have some experience. And it defines agricultural use value as a metric for determining this. So there's really a lot in the bill that is new for a farmland protection program. And although Vermont and Massachusetts have been doing this, it's not been in statute. So this would be a first.
Do you think he's going to sign it, Cuomo?
Yeah. Yeah, I am very hopeful. Of course, you get involved in policy long enough, you learn not to make bets or be too sure of anything. But it's a clear need and a really amazing opportunity for the governor to really cement his legacy in the program. The program was established by his father when he was in office as governor of New York. And now at the 20, having just passed the 20th anniversary of the program, I think this is a really perfect moment for the governor to take this next step, make sure the program continues to keep land in the hands of farmers for generations to come.
Well, Holly, I really hope it happens. It's going to be such an important precedent, I think, for other states, too, because we're starting this work in Pennsylvania.
Yes. Yeah, we are really excited. We have just hired a farmer organizer in Pennsylvania and a policy associate. So we're looking forward to working with the folks there. They have the most active and successful farmland protection program in the country. So they've tons of amazing work, and we're really looking forward to working with them to see how the program can evolve and continue to serve the needs of farmers, and especially the next generation of farmers in the future.
Well, congratulations. This session has been pretty exciting for the land program and all of your work on developing this bill and, you know, for the first time, hopefully in statute, really putting this value into place of farmers as landowners. It's amazing work. Thanks, Holly. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, and we got to give credit to David. David Howard is our...
Did it all.
New York State Land Access Policy Director, now our Northeast Policy Director, who was in Albany walking the halls
at 11
floor,
p.m.
on the floor of the Senate.
Two nights in a row, p.m. right? Or like...
Too many.
Too many.
And really got this done in Albany. We ate ice cream for breakfast the next day together.
Which solves everything. Well, Holly, I guess the next time you'll be on this podcast, we'll have to talk about ice cream.
Anytime.
Please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and like it if you actually like it. Thanks to everyone who made this, Hannah Beal, Holly Rippon-Butler, David Howard, who was a huge part of the New York campaign. And yes, he really did sit outside the New York State Legislative Chamber two nights, about until midnight, to get these bills passed. Thank you, David. Thanks so much for listening.